Welcome to the Just Fly Sports Performance Podcast, Episode 2. Today, I have Matt Gifford, Sports Performance Coach at NX Level in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Today's guest is Matt Gifford. I first met Matt at the Football Speed Consortium last December in Lombard, Illinois. Long before I had met Matt, I had been aware of his videos online, on Instagram, coaching, cueing, a lot of great speed training material. In addition to meeting him at the consortium, we also were able to catch a workout together at the facility where he works, NX Level Performance, and it was just a great time working with Matt, great being coached by Matt through a warm-up and a speed dynamic workout. And if you haven't seen Matt's videos, he posts a lot of really excellent material in the world of cueing, connecting the workout with the athlete, coaching sprint positions, and more. As far as his experience goes, he was an exercise science major, a CSCS, USA Track and Field certified. He's been an Altus apprentice and been involved in a lot of great things since he began coaching. And today we're going to focus on things like cueing and connecting what you're trying to see in a technique with the athlete. We'll discuss a little bit about warm-ups, skill acquisition, Matt's philosophy on speed and strength training, and more. I know you'll love it, and let's get to the show.
All right, so here we are with Matt Gifford. So, Matt, it's awesome to have you on the show, man. And just for starters, could you just chat a little bit about your background, both athletically and what led you to where you are as a coach right now?
No problem, Joel. Thanks for having me again. It's a honor to be the second episode of, I think, a budding and awesome podcast with such a awesome strength and conditioning coach and jump specialist, too. I am currently working in Waukesha, Wisconsin, which is my hometown, and actually, for the listeners, it's Joel's hometown as well, coincidentally. I grew up in the Waukesha area. I was a walk-on at Wisconsin for their football team for 1 year, got to experience strength and conditioning, Division I football there, and then transferred to a Division III school, Wisconsin-Whitewater, where I played football and finished my degree in exercise science. Was lucky enough to land an internship with NX Level in Waukesha, again, hometown, where there was an esteemed coach named Brad Arnett and another couple different guys, Jake Bodie, Nick Hansen, Jason Rowe, some awesome coaches in that area that I've learned from as well. And that's where my career kind of started, and it's been about 7 years since, working with a wide range of different populations and different athletes, like to say every make and model and every personality you could ever imagine in the sporting world and just in the world in and of itself. So it's been a great run so far.
Yeah, I'm really excited to chat with just some of your various experiences, specifically track and football. And I think the world of athletics has a lot to learn from track and field, and track coaches have a lot to learn from other sports as well as the strength and conditioning world. And the first question I'd really like to get your take on is, what's your take on building speed in football versus track and field? What are some commonalities? And then what are some things that you might emphasize in separating the two sports?
Great question. You're going to run across the exact same physics formulas for acceleration, force equals mass times acceleration, or acceleration equals force divided by mass, and that's going to have the same principle whether it's going to be track or football. The first three or four steps should be relatively similar, coming out of the blocks and executing a wide receiver start. But the big difference and similarities is the context involved. And if you're coming out of the blocks, we all know about head position and how it should be aligned with the spine if you're a 60-meter, 100-meter dash guy or woman. And in field sport, you obviously have to play with your eyes up and your head up. And you've got a different environment in that you're not running straight line on flat terrain. You're going to have to make cuts and create different angles and transition in and out. So I would say the biggest thing, besides the obvious of distances traveled and covered, is the environmental factors and the need for transitions. And that's why I think as strength coaches, it's really healthy for maximal output to kind of follow track and field programs and sprint-based programs. But in reality, we have to prepare these athletes for what they're going to see in any given competition or practice as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe take me through, if you're working a speed session for a field athlete, football, soccer, I guess those two aren't, too terribly similar, but, what would a developmental session for a team sport, field sport, athlete look like in terms of, you know, speed development? And I know
Sure.
we're going to get to things like, you know, warm up later. So maybe highlight the speed portion and talk about some things you would do there versus a linear, just a strict linear.
So I think the biggest thing with your younger athlete, your field sport athlete, is developing postural awareness. So with these kids specifically, I'm going to make use of certain stability exercises. Low-level elastic or plyometric jumps as well can really help them. But for them, it's just utilizing simple things like Prowler for strength or a sled drag for strength. Because not only is that going to help them with a specific or special strength cue, and that's going to carry over to their sprinting development, but it's going to help with creating a feeling state, an awareness of body position. So a typical session with them might start out with some type of, I guess, postural awareness exercise, whether it be an acceleration wall drill using a stability ball to cue triple extension and knee drive. I could pair that with some type of elastic hop just to work on stiffness and reactivity for them. And that's also helping them hopefully use some Bosch drills or poor man's variations of Bosch drills. It's going to help them understand how to create tension, how to apply force and land. And the big thing there is you're just looking for carryover and you're looking for transfer training. And especially with field sport athletes, you need to create familiarity with the other things they're doing in the weight room, the other things they've done in the past with their training. So once we're done there, we've done a couple of sprint drills just to provide more context and kind of help temper the body. We're going to focus on maximal output first and foremost, and we'll probably start with a two-point start. And that's probably one of the easiest spots to teach an athlete right from the get-go, helping them just understand how to develop shin angle, how to create tension from the belly up to the upper back, how to keep neutral spine, how to push and pop off the ground and clear their arms. The two-point start usually with every athlete, whether it's a 12-year-old youth or a 20-year-old college football athlete, is going to be the basis of what we do in our first progression. And let's say I'm working with a 20-year-old college football guy like I was last night. That workout would start with the Prowler exercise like I just talked, maybe 6 5-yard marches with about 180 pounds or roughly their body weight. And we would do that for special strength and also for potentiation. And then from there, we might get into maximal output sprints, so a 10, 20, 30, maybe even a 40 at the top. And that's going to help with your quote-unquote linear speed or track speed to increase that maximum output. And then from there, once I feel like they're kind of primed and we've worked on, I guess, building and tempering out the body, we'll probably back things off a little bit and shorten the yardage to something more applicable to their training. So I think most football players are going to be 2.5 to 3.5 seconds. So you're looking at acceleration from anywhere between 5 and 20 yards. So that's where we'll spend the bulk of our practice time. We can break things up according to readiness, you know. I don't see it that they need a ton of different gadgets. For me, if my kid can't master a two-point start or they can't master something on their feet, I will never put them on the ground. And I think popular track and field theory puts kids on the ground on their stomachs all too fast. So the push-up start is a classic exercise that we use, or the get-up start. You'll see a lot of football programs and a lot of YouTube videos doing that with their kids. And the fact of the matter is they're not ready for it, and the fact of the matter is you'll see a scramble up with a horrible back position, a horrible posture. They'll get to their feet, and they're in the two-point stance that they were already just in, and they're probably not even effective at getting out of that. So, you know, I've got a great mentor that says theory and reality are two different things, and, you know, just posted on it yesterday. You know, if you select an exercise, you cue it right, you motivate, you inspire, and it just still doesn't look right, then you probably picked an exercise that wasn't appropriate for them. So the big thing is understanding progressions, and we shouldn't be moving on as coaches and giving these athletes more when they haven't had some type of mastery with easy basics.
Yeah, that's an awesome answer, and you definitely encompassed a lot of really great things there. Just as I was listening to that, I was thinking of all these little anecdotes from working with some of my club track and field athletes, and you
sure.
know, sometimes I'll try to get them to do something, and they're just not getting it, and then I suddenly realize that I need to regress, you know, and
sure.
You're just talking about, like, the Prowler pushing, and I've seen, you know, groups of kids doing the hurdle push drill, you know, turn a hurdle around and push it, and you see bad posture just all over the place, you know, if you don't. And sometimes you need to slow it down just to the more remedial levels. And I think that's great stuff. I didn't realize too, you know, I've seen the progression for track athletes to go 2-point, then down to 3-point, then 4-point starts just for psychological easiness. But I'd never thought about that in the context of field sports too. And yeah, the great stuff all around. Let's move into some of the things you're talking about in cueing, visualization. Obviously, you know, it's great to have a good array of exercises. But, you know, obviously coaching, it's super important too, and I think that's something you bring a lot to the table with. So could you chat a little bit just about your approach to cueing athletes in regards sure. to the imagery you use and the wording?
Absolutely. So, you know, I was very lucky to be mentored early on in high school football by great coaches and teachers that always use stories and use analogies. And that was kind of my foundation. And, you know, I think as a coach, we just talked about it today with some interns, you have to figure out, you know, what are the cues and what are the words that are going to make things stick and kind of give kids aha moments, right? And everybody's going to be a little bit different. And even with cueing alone, sometimes words won't even do it because the kids and the athletes you're working with might be auditory, they might be visual, they might be kinesthetic. You know, sometimes you just have to put your hands in their body so they can feel certain positions. And that's also why we use certain drills to provide more context. But with cueing alone, I think there's been great literature out there and great work, and Nick Winkelman's a big name that's definitely helping a lot of people in this community. And specifically with sprinting, one of the easiest cues that I use for my athletes was something I learned from watching Maurice Green videos when he was training with John Smith back in the 90s. And they had some European videos that somehow got onto YouTube, right, when YouTube was kind of its heyday. And he used to always talk to his athletes about their block exit and their drive phase, as he coined it, an acceleration phase, and then they move into their transition at top speed. The analogy he always used, which is classic in our industry, is like an airplane off the runway. And I always tell my kids to be a great pilot, right? And if you're flying a helicopter, right, you'll pop straight up. And I guess my context is always, hey, if you're a bad pilot, what happens? You pop straight up, you cause turbulence, and then grown men like me are crying in their seats, and we don't want that. So for my kids, it's getting them to understand stories, using the external cues that we're kind of expanding upon now. And then that's where the great literature and knowledge is out there, is understanding that certain kids are going to be biased towards certain exercises, or we have to cue away from what they're biased towards right now. I got to work with a linebacker. He's actually a defensive end turn linebacker that was a complete over-dominant pusher. So with his development, with his pro day, never once did I tell him to push because I knew he was already biased to that, was coming out too hard, too low of angles, was overstriding, was spending a lot of time on the ground. So he was always a pop guy or a bounce guy. So it depends on the athlete. The big thing with the kids is with cueing alone, we just talked about creating familiarity. You know, build the warm-up as a cueing and teaching tool for the kids to come back to during speed development. So for me, the easiest thing to do to cue a kid how to create tension out of the start or keep tension while sprinting is to refer back to plank exercise, such a simple exercise. You know, obviously it's for stability, but how will they link that to their speed development? And I think you have to pull from what they already know and what they feel. That can be one of the easiest things is use what you already have.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's a great thing you mentioned. Going back to the warm-up is just huge. And you know, having those things in the scope of your workout that you can refer back to. And you know, your work, kind of in the cueing, along with Nick Winkelman has really it's influenced me in the way that I think I've kind of got on the cue, the cue train a little bit later than a lot of people have, but sure. I myself have just noticed, huge differences, and you'll say tell athletes something till you're blue in the face, and then all of a sudden you create a story that they understand, and it's like night and day with the movement, and
absolutely.
Yeah, I love that stuff. Could you chat a little bit about how you utilize a warm-up routine? I read some awesome stuff. The first article I've ever read of yours was based on the warm-up routine. You were talking about the physio ball and the physio ball march. And could you chat a little bit more about that and how you utilize a warm-up routine? You've talked about how things like it's the key to the workout, and just expand on that and some of those things that you do.
So the warm-up can be made into the most complex entity of your program, or you can just take it for what it is. You know, obviously you're raising core temperature, getting tissue ready, getting the body ready, tempering activation, CNS activation. The biggest thing I think is it's another time to just train general strengths. So oftentimes we see kids where their limiting factors are going to be stability, mobility, soft tissue quality, right? You know, movement efficiency at large. So I think the warm-up is a nice way to obviously raise that core temperature, but to kill a bunch of birds with that one stone. So for me, the warm-up starts with some type of torso activation or core activation, and that's going to be everything from the adductors and glutes all the way up to the upper back. It's a great piece, obviously, for general strength and to work on hitting what's often weak and dormant muscle groups. But it's a great piece, like we just talked about, to refer back to, you know, with your exercise later on in your program. I choose usually now to start my warm-ups and the warm-ups with some of my kids on the ground. Really benefited by my trip out to Altus to see their warm-up and how that worked, and pulled some things from there and used some things from the pre-existing one we had at Next Level, which I think was a little bit biased towards the classic Freezy base. And so working on glute activation to prime, you know, weak and dormant muscles, but to get more out of our activities ahead is going to be first and foremost important. Establishing mobility, hip mobility, thoracic spine mobility, and then getting kids up to their feet and obviously creating more blood flow from that standpoint, but hitting certain movement patterns, working on lateral chain exercises. We talked about a little bit through our podcast questionnaire about lateral chain and its use in the warm-up, and we at Next Level were affected by a UW Health Journal of Strength and Conditioning piece that saw to it that athletes that spent time moving laterally, side shuffles, karaokes, tapiokes, things of that nature, working lateral chain, oblique exercises in the warm-up alone, benefited greatly in terms of injury reduction from hamstring pulls. And then also the athletes that used that stuff moving forward from the hamstring pulls saw a reduction of reoccurrence from those injuries as well. So it's a big part of our program. The body obviously is a 360 entity, and we have to get out of that forward, backward, sagittal plane, which we kind of get stuck in sometimes. And you know, the warm-up also is a good piece just to work on certain things in your program that you might not hit that day, whether it's just general strength work through a single leg RDL, it's proprioception in and of itself. Or it could be providing you context for some of the exercise you do later on in your sprint work. So a lot of coaches like to use it for assessment tools. You know, but I think you have to have really great manual therapy skills to really use that for what it is. So I'm not one of those people that has quite that grasp yet. But more than anything, it's a tool for increased training volume, increased work capacity, and then obviously the key things are going to come to a little later on.
Yeah, absolutely. If I could expand on that last question too, and something that, you know, I've read in some of your articles, you talk about, you know, the lateral, which you just mentioned. You also mentioned coordination. And, you know, I've kind of found that myself in some of my warm-ups. My team warm-ups, I find myself, you know, if we're warming up on a carpet and there's different markings on the carpet, I'll tell people to, you know, jump on the different color dots, things like that. In your own warm-ups that you use, I'd be curious on both what you know, if you do anything specifically outside the typical karaoke for lateral.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure you do, obviously. And then what types of things do you use for coordination in the warm-up?
So here's something that's going to shock the world, right, and that everybody's going to get pissed off at. You can use a ladder for a warm-up. A ladder, doing simple skills. It's not going to create an agility freak, but with our young kids at Next Level alone, we use the ladder for the last 10 years. And with kids as young as 10 or 11, it is teaching coordination. It's teaching kinesthetic awareness. It's teaching them how to master certain patterns. You can go straight ahead in the ladder, you can go laterally, sideways. And it's teaching lateral chain stability if you're hopping on one foot. If you're doing a crossover skip, it can teach rhythm. It can teach body awareness. So there's definitely tons of different things you can do. And the ladder in itself is a light plyometric. You're working on foot speed. Yeah, with bigger athletes, it might confine you a little bit. Do you need a ladder? No, but you know, some of the exercises you're using can have great benefit to it. One of my favorite coworkers, a guy named Jason Rowe, is a professor at Carroll, talked about rhythm. A ladder is a great tool to enhance rhythm. You're teaching kids rhythm, and that's going to have some carryover, hopefully, generally, to what they're doing later on as well. You know, lateral work will do, whether it's some type of lunge matrix, you know, as a piece of the warm-up. We might incorporate some of that stuff. I've been a big fan of Gary Gray. He does a lot of lateral chain stuff in his kind of 360 warm-up pieces, and getting kids to move on their feet and establish proprioception, but also to work on intrinsic foot strength is going to be real helpful. And, you know, big fan of mixing things up with the warm-up. You know, it's healthy for older athletes. The younger kids need something that they can kind of create familiarity with. But there's so many different ways to skin a cat. And if you're kind of accomplishing certain principles, I think you can't go wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's so many ways to do the warm-up. And, you know, I do like how you talk about the speed ladder. I mean, it's funny. I feel like in some ways the strength coaching community that's so ready to destroy the speed ladder will also point right to how hopscotch and games kids play are so great. You know, I mean, it's just about context. It's not, you know, we're not using the agility ladder isn't the meat of the workout. You know, I'm not going to sit there and time you on it for the main speed portion, but it's a great warm-up tool and developing coordination. Sure. That's an awesome point. I think people... We sometimes get lost, and it's all about context.
Yeah.
Awesome. Moving on a little bit then, you know, one of the things I really liked that you talked about in a recent article we did worked on together was just on, you know, between field sports and track and field. You know, if track and field, say you're, you know, or whatever you're doing, if the field sport you're doing a little short to long preparation, but track can yield a aerobic base of sorts. And I think a lot of, you know, the track and field community is definitely heading in the right direction, putting speed at the premium level. But it almost in that regards, it's almost like, you know, we're losing some of the good things that aerobic development does help, you know, and in the conversations we've had, it was just a great reminder for me. So could you just talk a little bit regarding, you know, the aerobic factors in team sport athletics and then what your opinion is just on developing, you know, extended, you know, speed endurance, tempo sprinting, and for either track, football, or both, or field sports. I keep saying football, but you know, obviously any of those.
Right, and that's a question that we've jumped in the bandwagon. And I was guilty jumping on the bandwagon a little bit as well with the MMA crowd because I wanted to jump on every football strength coach's bandwagon as well with, you know, the thought that we don't need aerobic work, right? But simple things, you know, aerobic capacity is going to help with cardiac output. Oxygen delivery to tissues and muscles. With tempo work, we're going to improve blood flow. All of our athletes, you know, especially in season, are going to be in some type of sympathetic state. And when you've got better aerobic qualities, it's going to help with parasympathetic return and vagal tone. And I think the big thing is you have to look at, you know, what you're doing. And what coaches have a hard time doing is shutting off the performance training, you know, aspect where you're taking in a ton of great information. And with speed training, we know how to develop, you know, speed freaks and get guys really fast for 40. But the fact of the matter is, that's a long season from July or August to November or December. And how are you going to get through it? What type of work capacity do you have? How are you going to recover, more importantly, from all the work you're doing? I was somebody that was kind of guilty of trying to be my own strength coach in college. So whenever I got to my summer training, I was so hell-bent and focused on maximal strength work, on jumping higher, on sprinting faster, and I would pick one day on a Saturday to do my conditioning and my conditioning tests. And what happened every year was we'd run a 300-yard shuttle, and we'd practice that first day, and I felt like I was buried for the rest of the season. Would never get my legs back. Simply because I didn't develop enough work capacity in the off season, or enough lactic capacity or anaerobic capacity there to withstand the vigors of practice. And it's really funny, you know, if we look at all these different models and templates, right? Charlie Francis is going to cut off sprint work at maybe 400 to 500 yards for a track and field athlete, right? But the way I look at it is in a single two a day, a football wide receiver might run anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 yards of sprint work in one practice. they're going to be ruined if they haven't developed the capacity to do so. And then we throw into that, you know, the high-low training thing that we fell in love with over the last 10 to 15 years, right? Yeah, we can train high to low in the early off season, maybe even a little bit, I guess, during late winter, late spring. But the fact of the matter is, football is not a high-low game. You know, unfortunately, we practice 4 to 5 times a week. So essentially, Monday through Saturday, if you are in college football or NFL or even high school level, you're doing speed work every day. And you have to develop that. So that's why volume is really important. And you have to shut off what you know is absolutely best and figure out, well, what's best for that athlete to prepare them for that sport.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, energy system development, you know, obviously there's so many ways to get it done, so many ways you could take it. You know, maybe the 800, you know, you could look at a team sport in some ways as the 800. There's a lot of ways to accomplish it, but you can't forget that aerobic component because it is a part of it. You know, there's certain ramifications in developing anything there.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Cool. So along the lines of, as long as we're on maybe controversial or slightly controversial subjects, I'd like to chat with you a little bit about your take on, and you mentioned when you were kind of doing your own strength training, you were your own strength coach, you know, you really pushed maximal strength along with, you know, improve just pure maximal power, speed, jumping ability. But what's your point on the take of diminishing returns regarding the acquisition of maximal strength for field sport athletes? I mean, I guess primarily the big ones, you know, football, rugby, maybe even basketball, some of the sports where, I mean, you know, the strength and conditioning staff is generally going to get their greatest validation on seeing numbers. And then potentially also on track and field, you know, what's the point where you would shift gears or how would you address that?
Such a great question, and such a question that you're going to have probably a couple different answers. And all these sports are games of movement. So first and foremost, if movement qualities aren't there, if mechanical efficiency isn't there, then all the strength work you're doing, it's not going to transfer. And I think that's the biggest thing is, you know, we want to build big benches, build big squats, because we think in theory that's going to help with rate of force development, right? But if there's some issue with your training paradigm where you're not spending enough time on mobility or core stability, or you're not, you know, creating a program where there's proper progressions to get somebody to back squatting, then all that weight is going to be for naught, you know, and kids will just eventually implode and run into injuries and issues. So with strength alone, yes, we can't chase the beast. I think a lot of guys can really help themselves, and positionally it matters as well. You know, it's all dependent upon context like we talked about and what age group or what sport we're looking at. But I would agree with some of our track and field experts that you're going to get some diminishing returns with certain populations. And that's when you have to realize, you know, is there going to be an appropriate adaptation to the strength work you're prescribing moving forward, or have they hit that kind of capstone? But with that being said, you can still train it submaximally, and it doesn't have to be every week. It can be every couple weeks, and kids will still retain that, and they might even progress from that. And there's different variations you can use. I mean, if you look at some of the best triple jumpers and high jumpers like Yowash, while they might not be doing, you know, A to G run squats or back squats, they're still probably doing heavy quarter squats. You know, that's a form of maximal strength. So it all depends on the dose, you know, what the desired benefit is for it. I think chasing that squat beast that we always do, it's going to run itself to an end eventually. With young kids, I think anywhere between 13 and 19 or 20, within reason, you know, you can push to increase that squat, increase that deadlift, because that will have some return. But again, it all depends on the person and the athlete. You know, if you're a strength coach working with soccer players, right, especially female athletes, yeah, it's going to help them a little bit, right? It's going to help them hold positions and withstand all that aerobic work and all that high volume. But in the end, how is it going to make them a better soccer player? So it's definitely such a huge piece, but it's just one piece of that puzzle. And we always kind of fall into the trap of going, yeah, but everybody's weak and skinny and they lack strength. Not everybody's like that. We peg that. Everybody has a decent baseline. I see probably one every 5 or 6 kids that fall in that category, right? They still need to work on all these different qualities. respectively. And I just say, you know what? Honor your parent. Spend time everywhere. If there are certain times where kids really need to pay attention to it, then do so. But they should, these parties should be building together for the most part.
Yeah, I agree. Do you, you know, amongst the populations, you mentioned some of the younger populations versus, you know, maybe versus some of the more advanced athletes that are training at your facility. Do you, do you find you're typically, I mean, you know, this is just, you know, I don't want to, I guess, make assumptions. I would imagine, you know, yeah, and like you're saying, you know, college level and below, you know, you want to get them strong.
Right.
For some of the professional athletes that train at your facility, is there a kind of a different, you know, I think a lot of people who work with, you know, higher level athletes are more likely probably to talk about movement maybe so than you know, just developing strength in younger athletes and letting them learn skills. How do you see that working out in some of the professional or higher level athletes that train at your facility?
Yeah, so a lot of the athletes that will come into our facility, whether I'm working with them or whether my boss Brad is working with them, you know, after a long season, I got a basketball player I'm working with right now. He's a European player plays in Italy, and he leaves in August and doesn't come back till May. So he's, practicing 2 days at certain points as well, at the end of the season. So when he comes back, his nervous system is completely dampened. It's like shut off. He's like completely in a sympathetic state, lost all muscle mass, mobility and soft tissue quality just goes out the window. So first and foremost, before you do any strength work with them, they need to reestablish those areas. You know, those are going to be the biggest limiting factors moving forward. So once those things are on par and they've kind of recovered, then you can start to kind of bring back those qualities and train strength. It just depends on how you're doing it. You know, you're not going to find guys that are done with the season and they're in our weight room and they're back squatting within 3 or 4 weeks, right? We're still going to go through this exact same progressions with them. Once they're post-collegiate, we will probably not, unless they're some type of elite level shot putter, which we don't work with yet, we're not going to chase that beast, you know, and we're not going to injure guys in the pursuit of that. And the big thing is with any of these issues, you know, people have to understand, once you add load, it's just going to compound these issues. So we're very, very cautious. We do a great job of modifying things, you know, whether it be making their max effort exercise for a majority of the year just a trap bar deadlift and gain some benefit from it, and training a lot of posterior chain and single leg strength work. There's so many different ways to skin the cat, and they're at that level where I think you hit on earlier, those guys, you know, the diminishing returns, you know, they're probably already there. And they're such an elite crowd as well that they're not going to need much. They just need a little bit of a stimulus to go a long way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's great stuff. Awesome. So I have one more question for you, Matt. And this was something that I read that you wrote recently, and it was really intriguing to me because, honestly, it was one of those things that I hadn't heard specifically before, but it made a lot of sense. And I'd love to hear you expand on it. And that was just you were mentioning there was a specific intensity for skill acquisition. I believe the numbers are like 92% to 97%. And could you share a little bit more regarding that principle and how a coach might implement it?
So I got to give credit where credit's due. And if I screw up my work citation, I apologize. But I believe it was Martin Bissinger who wrote an article, gosh, about 2 to 4 years ago, I'm not sure. And it was kind of an aha moment for me. And he was talking about working with a hammer thrower, some type of throwing athlete. And for him, he said by backing off the athlete and focusing a little bit less on intensity and working at, I want to say he mentioned like 90 to 95 or 92.5%, he found that kind of the optimal flow zone for him, where he wasn't stressed out to hit a lifetime PR, but his intensity was on point, but it was controlled. And I got to also see Stuart McGill kind of talk about optimal flow zone, we'll call it, this past summer at the Perform Better Clinic. And he used GSP as his athlete, and he had GSP strike a bag with a leg kick. And he had him go, pardon my language, it was called balls out for 3 kicks, and then just said, hey, George, just back off a little bit. Just back off a little bit. And because of that relaxed flow state, he hit his highest power output. And that works really well with a lot of your acceleration athletes and with every type of speed development drill you're probably going to work with and do. You know, kids always get so aggressive because they think fast is always fast. And a classic line Charlie Francis used with his athletes accelerating is, hey, you don't have to be at full speed, you know, depending upon the athlete, 30, 40, 50, 60 meters of yard. So let that speed come to you. And if you get kids to back off a little bit, still be aggressive, right? Kind of controlled aggression. They'll understand and put themselves in a better position to hit patterns, and they'll feel patterns a little more effectively as well. And honestly, when you see guys relax a little bit, power output goes up, and you see a lot better result. I do that a lot with my pro day guys whenever we're running 10s or 20s, to say, hey, I'm going to have you guys do two reps. I don't even talk about going 100% or whatever. It's just kind of a given, obviously, if they're going to move as fast as they can. And I tell them, hey, let's just back off 5 to 10%, right? Just back off a little bit. Let yourself get full extension. Feel yourself hitting certain patterns. Stay relaxed. And we always, you know, use the line one of my buddies, Ben, swim coach, says, tension is the enemy of technique. So when you're backing off a little bit, you're less tense, you're more relaxed. And I think that zone is awesome for coaches to prescribe to their athletes when doing any type of sprint or deceleration or change direction drill. And when you look at all the change of direction drills and transition drills, and you look at athletes playing basketball, they're not pit bulls out there, right? They're very controlled. They're in a very relaxed setting. And I think that's when special things happen, is when aggressive athletes or powerful athletes learn how to back off just a little bit, so they can feel things out a little more effectively, and they can establish a certain rhythm. And that's when they really seem to fine-tune their technique as well.
Yeah, I love it. And one of the most striking things about that, and I remember back to a recent piece of writing you did on the controlled pit bull mentality, and you telling me that, you know, that little piece there just makes that a lot more, you know, I can see that a lot more in action there. And I think that track coaches, you know, I think anyone who's coached track and actually timed athletes doing, you know, 10-meter flies has probably seen that. You know, the athlete tries too hard and sprints poorly and maybe relaxes a little bit and goes faster. But I don't think a lot of people think about that for change of direction stuff, which you mentioned, or the flow of team sport and movement. And that's a great observation. I definitely am going to look at that, you know, in agility work that I do with like tennis athletes, like tennis and things like that. I think that's a great point.
I had a teammate of mine at Whitewater named Derek Stanley, right? He was a stud athlete, was drafted by the Rams in the 2008 draft, 2007, right? And he's a 24-foot long jumper, so you'd love him. Crisp, explosive, aggressive. And when he got to St. Louis, he was drafted by the Rams, he got to work with Isaac Bruce and Torrey Holt. And I still think about this concept with my agilities with kids and with, you know, receiver play, if I ever get to work with kids that play wide receiver. Torrey Holt and Isaac Bruce said, hey, we run all of our routes about 85 or 90%. It's all about control speed, right? You want to be aggressive, you want to be fluid, but it's about being controlled in and fast out. And the same thing goes if you watch the rhythm of somebody playing on a football field, or, you know, watch somebody set something up on the basketball court. They know how to control it, and then they know how to transition effectively so they can be fast and they can accelerate appropriately out.
Awesome. Yeah, I love it. And I think that's real valuable for anyone who works with track or multi-directional athletes. Yeah. So great stuff, Matt. Cool. Well, hey, I think that's about it for our time together today. Man, I loved having you on the show. Lots of great points. I know the coaches at home are going to really get a lot out of this too. And you're definitely one of the more progressive writers today in terms of, especially what you just talked about, visualizing just the art of coaching all this stuff. You know, it's easy to, you write sets and reps, but implementing it and creating the stories and just your approach, that's amazing. And the readers are going to, or the listeners are really going to benefit from that.
I appreciate that. Thanks for all you do, Joel.
All right. Absolutely, man. I'll talk to you later.
Take care.